This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. And along with me, as always, is Greg Harvey.
That's me.
And Jacob Crum.
It's my pleasure and your pain.
It's my pain, always.
It's my pleasure.
I always enjoy having you, Jake. I'm sorry. Even if it is painful. It's good stuff. Either way, welcome to Follow the Sound. We're doing another episode of This Week in Music History, and I am excited because we have a lot of stuff to get through today because a ton of stuff happened this week. I mean, a lot of stuff. And I'm pretty sure that we're all going to be very excited about this once we, you know, actually get rolling into it. But first, I would like to say, if you enjoy this show, or you just enjoy listening to us, or you want to yell at us and tell us what we got wrong, you can go and find us on Facebook at Follow the Sound Podcast, or you can find us on Twitter at iFollowTheSound. I will respond to anything sent to me because I'm that type of a guy. I enjoy interacting with our fan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's nice.
I like that guy.
Also, if you want to support the show, you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com. And on the right-hand side, you'll see an Amazon banner. Click on that banner. Takes you to Amazon. Do all your normal shopping. Won't cost you anything else, but we get a referral. And it gives us a little bit of money back to help the show continue on. So go to the website on the right-hand side or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon.
Yes.
Now on to This Week in Music History.
Send all your mail to Brian Kroc, and we're going to throw in some fake news for you so that
we
know if you're paying attention or
not. That's not going to happen. We strive for exactitude on this show.
I'm going to say the wrong year and see if you catch it.
I'm going to get that wrong anyway. I don't pay attention to years. I pay attention to the day.
The Rolling Bones?
Really? There is a band out there called the Rolling Bones, so you're just making a fool of yourself now.
Made their second appearance on BBC?
No, they did not do that.
Okay.
Either way, let's get into it first. Jake, however, didn't stick to the rules because we normally only do five days.
5 days, right.
He went back one day, but when he told me what it was, I had to let him have this one. So, Jake, what is our first fact of the day?
February 26th, 1917, the very first jazz single is recorded in Nashville by the original Dixieland Jazz Band, and the single is Livery Stable Blues.
Yes.
Wow.
And interesting to note, jazz on that release was spelled J-A-S-S.
Yes, it was. They didn't change it to Z-Z until later on because people kept striking out the J's.
Wow.
The funny other thing, too, is that there was an opportunity to record a jazz album well before that with some of the jazz musicians down in New Orleans. They all refused. Because jazz was improvisational. It, you know, you couldn't record it. Like, that'd be stupid.
And you cannot contain this art form.
So they all, like, shunned it. And then the Dixieland Jazz Band was like, yeah, we'll do it. Pay us. And that's exactly what happened. And so they got credited with the first jazz recording. And all the rest of those losers were just like, you can't do that. And so thus started the first real rivalry of jazz recordings.
I think that's pretty good. Jazz is America's only true native music.
Yeah, except it was influenced by a bunch of other stuff, too.
Well, yeah, they're all influenced by something else. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a great show to put on.
True, true. I think it's funny, though, like the certain things that are considered like Americana, like the banjo. The banjo is an African instrument. It's like it just happened to make it big in America, and it's not really big in Africa anymore.
We played it better and faster.
We did that three-fingered picking. Nobody else did that.
And then Steve Martin came along.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, you know who I prefer for playing like the banjo and stuff is Bela Fleck.
Steve Martin?
You're giving me this blank look. Have you ever listened to Bela Fleck play?
No, but I think I'd like to.
The dude was a master. Is a master. He's still alive. I mean, it's just mind-bogglingly good at his craft. And so, yeah, if you ever get a chance, check out Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. That's the group that he has.
I do like that name.
There's like no vocals in it. It's just him jamming. So, but there you go. There's my weird little addendum to the factoid. All right, so let's move on to the other day. February 27th. I like this. This is some good stuff that I got, okay? So, 1964, 21-year-old former hairdresser and cloakroom attendant at the Cavern Club, Cilla Black was number one in the UK singles chart with Anyone Who Had a Heart.
Mm.
No?
No.
Cilla Black.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know who Cilla Black is?
No.
She was a, like I said, she was a former hairdresser and cloakroom attendant at the Cavern Club, which means that she knew the Beatles, and the Beatles really encouraged her to be a singer. And so she started to go out and do these things. So then she records the song, Anyone Who Had a Heart, originally written by Burt Bacharach, and just huge, massive hit. And it's to this day, my dad even talks about this song because he actually really loved that song too. So that's actually the reason why I put it in there.
It's good to know people. In her
Jake,
case.
Jake, you got another little factoid for me?
Yes. Again, February 27, 1970, Jefferson Airplane is playing at the Civic Center Music Hall in Oklahoma. No, excuse me. Yes. Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
There Oklahoma we go. City, Oklahoma.
Somehow that's really hard in my brain. And after the concert, they were fined for profanity $1,000.
The venue had a swear jar? Really?
No, no, no. The law was put into place after an event that we'll cover shortly.
Okay.
So I always think it's funny, like a Jefferson Airplane, because their evolution of music is by far one of the strangest things that I've ever seen in music history. Because not only were they huge in the 60s and 70s with songs like White Rabbit and, you know, that, like, of which became the soundtrack to like a couple of different Vietnam-based movies and a bunch of other hippie films as well. But then they progressed on through the 70s, still recording stuff. And then they progressed into the 80s after having changed from Jefferson Airplane to Jefferson Starship to then just Starship, creating the strangest pop single of all time. We built this city on rock and roll.
If you didn't love pop, maybe you'll love pop in the future? Question mark.
In the future, everyone listens to music just like this.
Oh, man. It just that band cracks me up with their strange development into their artistry. So
they were awesome. I liked, yes. I liked the old, like, what's the word they call it? Psychedelic rock? Is that it? Yeah.
Yeah. It was psychedelic rock, and then psychedelic rock really became prog rock later on. So.
I preferred the psychedelic rock. I just like kind of that old early roots, you know, where they're just starting to kind of get their legs under them as far as really rocking.
See, for me, I couldn't do it. Like, the psychedelic rock for me does nothing for me.
Like, I mean, I don't know if I'd sit and listen to
prog
it all
rock,
day,
though,
but it's
that,
cool.
That stuff gets me. But for some reason, the psychedelic, the stuff that's like, you know, only really good if you're high, that stuff never influenced, mainly because I'm never high.
Well,
so
I think if it's something that is really good without being high, that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, but then that just evolved into jam bands.
Well, I don't like jam bands.
So there you go.
I don't like your 12-minute songs. Get out of my face with
it. It's the same thing about how disco just evolved into techno. I mean, it's the exact same progression.
Same problem.
Exactly.
Their songs became 30 minutes long.
So let's move on. We got
Janis Joplin, speaking of which.
Yes, yes. Speaking of going back to the 60s, it's 1971, actually. 5 months after her death, Janis Joplin started a 9-week run at number one on the U.S. album chart with her second and final solo studio album, Pearl.
And I think it's super creepy how she sang all the songs except for one, because she passed away before she could do the vocals on it. And that song just happened to be called Buried Alive in the Blues.
Yep.
Kind of haunting.
It is very haunting.
Mm-hmm.
Up next, we got 1988. George Michael scored his sixth number one U.S. single with Father Figure. I will be your father figure.
I don't know why. That sounds creepy.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, it's this very impassioned kind of song.
Well, George Michael, like, the way he sings it, it seems sincere, but like when you try and replicate it, it comes off creepy. No offense to you.
All right, and then actually, I from 1988, I got a big jump to 2010. This one I actually thought was really kind of funny, and I was trying to figure out how they knew that this happened today, or if it was just a report that was released that, oh, this happened, we released this report announcing this today. But what it is, in 2010, U2 raked in more money than any other music act in the U.S. in 2009, making $109 million from touring, record sales, and other royalties. Almost twice the amount that the second runner or their second place person got, which was Bruce Springsteen, who took home $58 million.
Can you imagine?
Followed by Madonna at $47 million. AC/DC at $44 million and Coldplay with $27 million.
I can't imagine. I mean, you two are the only people who could possibly be like, yeah, you know how much money Bruce Springsteen makes? Double it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I mean, if you remember back in 2010, that was like in the height of their 360 tour.
Oh, yeah.
And they had the spaceship and stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. Here at Busch Stadium, I was at that concert.
Wasn't that?
And it was crazy. It was insane. It was also the hottest day of my life, and I wanted to die.
Was that How to Dismantle an Atom Bomb or something like that? Isn't that the name of the album?
Ooh,
that's the one that
I don't
had
know.
Vertigo on it.
Hello, that, man, hello. My wife would have to. My wife would have to tell you that one.
Vertigo.
I'm actually not like the biggest U2 fan.
Which this in but, the song, you remember the song started though? Uno, dos, tres,
catorce.
And you're like, what?
Which of course Saturday Night Live made fun of that. Cracked me up. All right, let's move on to February 28th in 1968. 25-year-old Frankie Lyman, lead singer of the Teenagers, died of a heroin overdose in his grandmother's New York home.
You're 25 years old, doing heroin in your grandma's house?
In 68.
Tisk, tisk.
Even worse than that, though, I mean, this is Frankie Lyman. Frankie Lyman, actually, after the fact, there three different women claiming to be his wife all sued for, like, the money involved in his estate. And he was 25. I mean, he had a very, like, basically a 10-year career, because he started when he was a teenager with the Teenagers. And, doing the, Why Do Fools Fall in Love and Rockin' Robin, I think, was the other one that he did.
Mm-hmm.
Tweedledee-dee-dee-dee. So, but the Why Do Fools Fall in Love was always a great song. So it's just funny to see, not funny, it was sad to see him go from, like, this heights of pop music with such an incredible voice to dying at the age of 25 with three supposed wives and, he was just a drug addict at that point.
He was supposed
weird,
to record.
Weird, man. He crashed.
He was supposed to record the very next day, too.
Mm-hmm. He was. I think he tried to record Why Do Fools Fall in Love, like, a couple of times, too. Like, to try and, get some of that money back.
Well, he was 25, but he put out Why Do Fools Fall in Love when he was 13. Mm-hmm. Trying to ride that cash wave.
Yes, he
all
was.
All the way to the shore.
Yes, he was. In 1970, in an interview with the New Musical Express, Fleetwood Mac's Peter Green talked about his plans to give all his money away to charity.
I think he was losing all his marbles, too.
The following year, Green confronted his accountant with a gun after he sent him an unwanted royalty check.
Listen, I keep trying to tell you, don't give me this money.
I don't want your money.
It's like, come on, dude. He was British, though, wasn't he? So I'd have to do that in a British accent.
Can't buy me love.
It's like, come on. I just want you to give my money away to a charity.
If you come near me with that check, I swear.
That was very Michael Caine that I just did, and I don't know why I did that.
Go on, endorse it.
I'm Michael Caine.
Oh, but I guess the good news... of course,
didn't he go to prison or the asylum after that or
something? He was committed to a mental hospital in 73. That's not the good news. The good news is that he tried to relaunch his career in the 90s.
Oh, well. It was Peter Green. He is well known, especially for the people who really get into the original Fleetwood Mac stuff. But I like Peter Green because he recorded a very good guitar part on the song. I believe it's Oh Well. And I really enjoy that song. I like Lindsay's version better, though, but that's just because Lindsey's an incredible guitar player.
We got into that last week, all about Lindsey Buckingham. If you like Lindsey Buckingham, go back to our previous week's podcast. You'll hear a nice little segment about him.
And find me on social media so I can then pester my wife saying, ha-ha, look at all these other people who like Fleetwood Mac. And I'll send them to her so then she can chat with them because I know she'd love that.
Can I share this next one, Brian?
Yes, go ahead.
This is probably one of my favorite ones from tonight's show. I mentioned this before we got started. 1970, the same day, Led Zeppelin.
Oh, yes.
They played a gig in Copenhagen, but they played the gig under the name The Knobs. Yes, The Knobs, because it turns out that the relative of the actual inventor of the Zeppelin.
Ava von Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not joking. That's her name.
Yep. She threatened to sue if the family name was used at all in Denmark. She could be the only Zeppelin in this
the
country.
The only Zeppelin.
That's not, it probably would have sounded. That's not a Dutch accent.
I don't care.
This is the
much more like no do we? One Zeppelin in this here country at one time. I keep telling you people from the England to use my name.
You are now the Knobs.
You know what's bad? I actually totally went through this like documentary about Zeppelins and like the history of them and
actual
dirigibles
Zeppelins?
And stuff.
Dirigibles?
It was very interesting, like sort of the rise and fall, because we could have had a very different history had like the Hindenburg not gone up in flames.
Mm-hmm.
Like it would have been crazy. Like,
in a way,
and the reason, you know why? Actually, the entire reason as to why all that stuff really happened was because Over in Europe, they were all using hydrogen because they couldn't use helium because America had a monopoly on helium.
I still don't understand.
Sorry about that.
I kind of still don't understand how we get helium. I know that that should maybe be a basic answer, but helium comes from the sun.
In every natural gas deposit, there's a large mixture of gas. And it just so happens that the deposits in the U.S. have enough helium that you can actually isolate it. That combined with the fact that the gas that you shoot into natural gas to push helium out doesn't transport very well, and we have a ton of it in the U.S.
Oh, okay.
And it's an inert gas, but it's pretty unstable. I forget which one it is. It's one of the noble gases.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. You're totally out of my territory. So,
well, look, I'm going off the fly on this.
No, that's okay. So, yeah, but America had a monopoly on helium, and so therefore we couldn't. Huh. We refused to sell it to the Germans because we didn't know what type of war applications they would use
it for. Yeah, trade embargoes.
And they went down like a Led Zeppelin.
Yep.
Mm-mm.
Well, the Hindenburg, but okay.
Oh, no, I just meant Europe's Zeppelin project. Went down like a Zeppelin.
Here's an interesting fact.
Go ahead.
The recording that you hear of the radio broadcaster who live recorded the Hindenburg falling.
Yes. Humanity.
Oh, the Humanity.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which I never actually fully understood. And what it was is the dude was just so overcome with emotion, mm-hmm. though, that he said that, even though it doesn't actually make sense.
Yeah, he was walking around with a portable. It was a 200-pound piece of recording equipment.
Yes, it was.
Reel-to-reel machine.
Ultralight.
And every time you've heard that, Brian,
yes,
you've heard it at the wrong speed. It's too fast.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. It's actually, the reels are supposed to spin at a really insane ratio.
Oh,
that
yeah?
No one has recording equipment for. And the Smithsonian, rather recently, in the last 5 or 6 years, took tapes over to Europe and re-recorded it on equipment that would get the speeds right.
Wow.
Because the ratio was like supposed to be like 3:7 or something weird. So every time you've heard it, it's about 0.25% too fast.
All right, Brian.
That's awesome.
Insert audio clip here.
It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now. And the flame is crashing to the ground. Not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the fans are screaming around it.
It's haunting if you actually hear it.
Oh, the humanity.
Let's get on to the next thing here.
How about there's still at least
you
one
just
or two
did Led
more.
Zeppelin.
Yeah.
So I mean, here, let me do one more.
But it's from the same day, though, right?
Well, I got from the same year.
That's what I'm saying. Same year, same day.
What you got?
Simon and Garfunkel?
That's what I was going to do.
Please do.
All right. Simon and Garfunkel started a 6-week run at the top of the U.S. singles chart with Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Mm-hmm.
Like a bridge over troubled waters. I hope these people enjoy our singing because this is hilarious to me.
I wanted to talk about this just so we could sing the song.
Yeah, me too.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jake, you got something?
February 28th. 1977?
Do it.
Okay.
What you got?
So, Ray Charles has just taken the stage.
Mm.
He is at, well, he's in L.A. somewhere.
And
I don't know where he's
remember,
at.
He is blind.
He is a blind person.
Mm-hmm.
He is playing at a benefit concert for Rosie Greer, the NFL linebacker.
Nice.
His charity called Giant Step.
Mm-hmm.
Bette Midler has taken the stage and
Ooh.
Left. Elton John has taken the stage and left.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce Springsteen has just left the stage. Ray Charles walks on and he begins to play the song, I Can See Clearly Now. And someone in the audience, which total of about 3,000, a member of the charity group Giant Step, burst onto the stage with a rope in hand and begins to strangle Ray Charles to death.
It was a microphone cord.
Was it now?
Yes.
Strangle him with
improvisation.
Tried to strangle him with a microphone cord. Like, I think that was just that happened to be on stage.
Okay. And the only other person on stage was Ray Charles's manager. And the two of them were able to subdue the man. Ray Charles exited for a moment, came back on, finished the song.
Wow.
Left the stage, talked to police officers, refused to press charges. The young man apologized and told him that I only did it because I had divine inspiration. I was convinced that God told me if I strangled you, your eyesight would return. I can see clearly now.
Wow.
That is grand.
Yuck.
Oh, my God. That's perfect.
Crazy people.
Onwards to 1986. George Michael announced that Wham! Would officially split during the summer.
Ooh.
Wham! Sold more than 25 million certified records worldwide from 1982 to 1986.
What did people do those 4 years?
I don't know.
Sit and twiddle their thumbs?
Something like that. But they all went out and bought Wham! Albums, apparently.
Well.
Wake me up before you go, go. Moving up, we got 1994, Eric Clapton. This one I really liked, actually, because we went onto the Royal Albert Hall last time. Eric Clapton played the 100th performance at London's Royal Albert Hall in aid of the Children's in Crisis charity. That's a lot of times to play at the Royal Albert Hall. That place is huge. I mean, it's massive, so that just cracks me up. Up next, in 1997, Death Row Records boss Marion Suge Knight was sentenced to 9 years in prison for violating his probation for a 1995 assault conviction. Under U.S. law, Knight would not be allowed to run Death Row Records while in prison.
Okay. So, was it 94 that Tupac got killed?
That I don't know.
Because everybody says that
Suge ordered it.
Suge killed Tupac.
Ordered it.
Yeah. So, 9 years in prison, I feel like people just kind of wanted to see that happen. And if he had a 95 assault conviction, I don't think he stood a chance.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure he had a few convictions, but...
Well, but he couldn't run Death Row Records while he was in prison, and that was huge.
That was massive. That was kind of a weird thing to do, but at the same time, I mean, it made sense.
Well, it's like, you're in prison. You shouldn't be making millions and millions. Have you seen the new Straight Outta Compton movie?
Straight Outta Compton!
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was really good, except for the fact that basically it seemed like Ice Cube and Dr. Dre were basically like patting themselves on the back. That's really what the entire movie seemed like to me. I enjoyed it as a biopic, and I thought that it was really good. But at the same time, it was just like, yeah, it was like, and this is how much of a genius, you know, Ice Cube and Dr. Dre were.
Yeah.
That's what the movie was.
Well, I mean, Ice Cube and Dr. Dre were the two biggest names to come out of it. I mean, Eazy-E, you know, R.I.P.
was huge, yeah.
Yeah, but he was cut too short.
True.
I thought that movie was great, though. I learned a lot about it. But what I was getting at, though, was that there was a lot of scenes
in
the movie.
I learned that Paul Giamatti can show up in any movie.
That he will not turn down a role.
Will not turn down a role to save his life.
A paying gig. There was a lot of scenes in that movie where they were showing kind of the inside behind the scenes of Death Row Records, or at least, mm-hmm. you know, the movie's interpretation of it. But that was really interesting.
Yes.
I like seeing that.
That was when they showed Tupac and... the guy who played Tupac. And actually,
that was cool.
That was the funniest thing that I thought out of everybody who went and saw the movie. They said, like, did you see the dude who played Tupac? It's like, that dude looked exactly like Tupac. Like, there are people seriously like, the dude who played Tupac was Tupac.
Why not?
It's like, he's still alive.
He probably was.
I was like, I'm pretty sure he's not. But everybody was like, give that dude a movie. Like, make a Tupac movie using that dude.
Now
and I was like, all right.
That is a good idea.
I think Tupac does deserve a movie.
The movie should be what Tupac's done since Tupac died.
That's a great concept.
Oh, that would be hilarious.
That's a great film. Like, I would great like that immediately. Kickstart everything.
The movie starts with him, like, laying on the street in Vegas, and he's like, that's the day I died. Or so they thought.
It was also the day that I truly started to live.
Yeah.
In the Midwest.
Tupac. Popular.
Tupac.
Apocalypse.
Live from Oklahoma.
What, he's like standing over the Twin Cities, Iowa, Des Moines, like, soon this will all be mine.
He's just like there in some random suburban backyard.
Oh, yeah.
Grilling.
If you build it, he will come. It's Tupac.
And his neighbors, he was just like, I was Tupac. And they're just like, yeah, Bill, you're funny. Because he had to change his name.
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah.
And now he's Bill.
Wow.
I'm just saying. In 2008, Boy George pleaded not guilty to falsely imprisoning a male escort by chaining him to a wall.
Not guilty?
Yep.
So you chained him to the wall, but you're also pleading not guilty.
Well, if it was all agreed upon.
He just didn't let him go?
Yeah, it's like...
Look,
you said you were going to do 35 minutes. Only been 32. I paid you for 35 minutes
he
to be chained to this wall.
He was chained to the wall long enough to sue, I guess. I mean, you have to be there for a while to be like, okay, seriously? You need to come unchain me from this wall. It's not fun anymore.
Not fun.
And I'm charging by the minute.
All right. So finally, in 2008 as well, on the same day, drummer Buddy Miles, who was Jimi Hendrix's drummer in his last regular group, Band of Gypsies, died age 60 in his home in Austin, Texas. Poor guy.
That's a bummer.
But
love Jimi Hendrix.
Lived longer
experience.
Than Jimmy. So there you go. Mm-hmm. He at least had a longer life to go around.
I was going to say, he achieved a certain amount of notoriety in the U.S. as a vocalist on the celebrated claymation California Raisins.
Oh, nice. That's great.
Yeah, you got to get that in there.
All right, so on to March 1st.
March 1941?
No! Wait, time out.
Wait.
Hold up, Brian.
What you doing?
You're forgetting about a special day.
No, I'm not.
We go
from February 28th to March 1st.
Oh, you know the song. It only comes once every 4 years.
The president?
February 29th.
Oh. February 29th, but we don't have a February 29th this year.
We don't this year, but there were February 29ths in the past.
Okay, ooh. You know what? Since we had one last year, it would be 4 years of this before we can actually get to do it. So why not? Let's go ahead and do it. What you got?
Well, I'm glad.
I'm going to fill up my tea while you're doing this, too. So there you go.
Okay. How about this one? Since you wanted to skip over February 29th, 1968, The Beatles.
The Beatles.
Did I get your attention there?
I'm going to do my best Foley artist.
That sounds so real.
It's very real because it is. Yeah. Some of my coworkers really hate that because it makes them have to go to the bathroom. I say, shut up, old men. Just deal with it.
Well, 1968, February 29th is a pretty big day because...
What you got?
The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper...
Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band...
They won Album of the Year.
For the Brit Awards?
at the Grammys.
Oh, wow. That was a Grammy win.
They won Album of the Year, Best Cover, and Best Engineered and Recorded Album at the Grammys that year.
Wow, that was impressive.
That was a big day. February 29th. Let's see.
Why can't the Grammys just be like that every 4 years? It's like, can they just do for the last like 4 years?
That would that kind of could would be cool.
The
in a
Music
way.
Olympics.
Yeah. 1976, a special leap year concert went on. None of the bands are worth any while, but they had a leap year concert, so.
That's kind of a letdown, but okay.
Two members of Lynyrd Skynyrd in 1977 knocked unconscious after a fight between the band and members of the Metropolitan Police boxing team who were holding a dinner at the Royal Lancaster Hotel in London.
Really?
And Lynyrd Skynyrd guys got into it with professional boxers that were also police officers.
That is great.
And got
Don't
knocked
give a
out.
Damn.
Wow.
We was at this hot tub first.
Ooh, here's a creepy one. 1980, the glasses that Buddy Holly was wearing when he died were finally found in Mason, Iowa, after being there for 21 years.
Crazy.
Wow.
That's insane. I mean, I wonder how those were lost. Like, you'd think they would have been found pretty close to the crash site.
You would thought 21 years, Buddy Holly's glasses were laying in a cornfield? What?
I mean, maybe. A farmer found it, and he's like, well, I need a new pair.
No. So the truth is that actually, I think a police officer took them.
Oh, okay.
And put them in storage is the real story here, yeah. And just kind of forgot about them.
Wow.
21 years until somebody was like, wait a second. You have Buddy Holly's glasses, dude. What? Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. No, that one's good. I like that.
What's your opinion on Mr. Big?
Like the guy like from that one movie?
No, Billy that Sheehan's TV show? Band, kid.
1992.
Wasn't there a Mr. Big in like that Sex and the City show?
You tell me.
I don't know.
I don't know.
The only reason I know that is because my wife likes to go and play on the Sex and the City slot machine. Over at the old Lumiere.
Oh, you know what? Actually, I do know what you're talking about now that you mention it.
You're such a Miranda.
92, Mr. Big started a 3-week run number one on the U.S. singles chart with To Be With You. Ooh.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds good.
Let's see. In 2000, February 29th.
You had a lot for February 29th, didn't you?
I know,
jeez.
Yeah. 2000, Eric Clapton was banned from driving for 6 months after speeding. He was going what in a what? Anyone? Hmm? Anyone?
Ooh.
Was it in the U.S.?
It was not in the U.S. It was
so
in his
metric.
Home. It was in his home. Well, it's in miles per hour for our purposes.
Mm.
What do you think, Eric Clapton? 6 months.
What was he driving?
Oh, I don't know. A vehicle.
My Maserati does 185.
Okay. All right. So it was a 30-mile-per-hour speed zone. How fast was it going?
97.
Probably an Aston Martin, so.
30-mile-per-hour speed limit.
97.
He was probably doing 120, at least.
You guys. He got arrested for doing 45 and a 30.
What?
6 months. Eric Clapton. They don't even take away licenses anymore. Look at Justin Bieber.
Sir, wait, you're Eric Clapton, aren't you?
I got two more, and then I'm done with this weird leap day, okay?
Yeah, that's what it was. The arresting officer and the judge both purchased tickets to an Eric Clapton show, and he didn't play Layla.
Yeah.
And they're like, now we got him.
How dare you? On the same day in the year 2000.
In the year 2000.
Yeah. Sir Elton John. Get this, he stormed out of the opening night of his brand new Broadway musical, Aida, after only 15 minutes, complaining that they had ruined his songs. This was like his play, his baby.
But obviously then he wasn't involved in like the actual production process.
Yeah, they bastardized it, I think.
He
would
probably
be
just,
to put it...
just wrote the songs and then was like, here you go.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen the play too. It's pretty good, but... I guess I kind of see where Elton John maybe didn't dig it because I don't know if I'd maybe dug it. So.
Well, I mean, he was producing songs for a lot of different musicals back then.
Oh, yeah. So maybe that was more of kind of a cash thing.
I think he just wrote them songs and then like gave them to him. And then they're like, Elton John wrote it. And then he showed up and then they were just like, oh, hey, we converted everything over to this other type of song. Okay.
We changed the key to every song you wrote. And last one.
Elton John changed the keys to every song he wrote. I saw him in concert a couple years ago. He can't hit any of those high notes anymore.
Oh, man.
He had to lower the keys of like every song. And
Hold me closer, Tiny Dancer.
Tony Danza.
All right, I got one last one for the 29th. We can get out of this weird Twilight Zone.
Okay, good.
In 2012, Davy Jones, Manchester-born lead singer with the 60s band. Anyone?
The Monkees.
The Monkees.
Hey, we're the Monkees.
Hey.
People say we're monkey around.
He died. Age 66 in his sleep at his home in Florida after suffering a massive heart attack. He you know, you may have heard of Coronation Street.
Yes.
He was in the soap opera as a teenager. And, get this, he was also a budding jockey, a horse racer.
The first thing I ever actually saw him in, though, was a musical production of Oliver.
Really?
Yeah.
Did he have a lead role?
No, he was
like orphan number five.
No, he was like an older kid, actually, like an older orphan kid or something. But yeah, it was crazy.
He was like the mean one that took Oliver's soup away from him.
But he was a jockey?
Yeah. So it turns out that he had a very small stature for those who only saw him on TV.
He was pretty short.
Mm-hmm. Turns out he remained a keen horseman all his life, even winning his first race in England as a jockey in 1996.
Wow.
So I did not know that about Davy Jones before
today.
That's
impressive.
Mm-hmm. And that's it for the Oddball, February 29th.
All right. Let's get on to March 1st. Jake, I think you have something.
Yes, March 1st, 1941. The first FM broadcast in the world. Nashville, Tennessee, radio station W47NV, and the bandwidth is the most interesting part of this story.
What is it?
44.7.
Oh, wow.
44.7 megahertz.
That's weird.
FM.
That is strange for an FM station.
Yeah.
You know what FM stands for? Well, us being radio people obviously know this because FM stands for frequency modulation.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And AM stands for amplitude modulation.
And AM goes farther, but FM sounds better.
Yes. And AM likes to bounce off of stuff a lot.
Yes, it does.
FM does not so much.
Mm-mm. Billboards.
The station that, of course, we are associated with, the Mighty Mox from St. Louis, that signal has been heard pretty much across the globe.
They've said that there's...
Due to atmospheric bounce, it's been picked up in places like Japan and...
Yeah, New Zealand.
Yeah.
South Africa.
Yeah, it's been insane just like how far the signal will actually travel on a clear night.
Can you imagine, though, being in like a country like Iceland and you can turn on KMOX St. Louis?
That's just insane. I got family down in Louisiana and they listen to the Cardinals games on the Mighty Mox at night because the signal carries. It's an amazing thing. So the first ever FM station at 44 on the FM dial.
44 on the FM dial.
Like, did they have stingers back then like that? That would have been awesome.
They did, but they all sounded a little bit more like this. Ah, here's a stinger, take it in the kisser.
Does it say anything about their programming?
No. I know that they quit broadcasting in 51.
Okay.
And then 6 years later, they changed the dials for FM. So they were broadcasting on like 100 something.
So now you can't get anything lower than like 87.9. Yeah. So,
and for the record, for those of you out there, the higher the frequency, the better the sound quality.
Generally, yes.
That's why like all the 88 and like 89 point somethings are like public radio.
Mm-hmm.
It's because those frequencies aren't as quality. Just so you know. Fun fact.
Hey, when you're selling soap, you got to use the best quality possible.
Oh, yeah. That's when you get like 107.9 or something.
All right. So, March 1st, 1961, Elvis Presley signed a 5-year movie deal with producer Hal Wallace. During his career, Elvis made a bunch of feature films.
Like the notable
Blue Hawaii.
Blue Hawaii.
Blue Hawaii.
The only Elvis film I've ever sat through because your father, Brian, forced me to do so.
Let's see. There's Kissin' Cousins. And then there's like
another one at the beach.
And well, there's a ton of beach ones. I'm trying to remember.
Wasn't there like Elvis versus the volcano or something?
Ooh, this one I've got to look it up. Hold on. So, because all the Elvis movies.
I've never seen an Elvis film, to be honest.
What, really? He's a kaiju now. He's just fighting like natural disasters. Elvis versus the hurricane.
Yeah.
Elvis versus the tornado.
Well, I'm thinking more like Ernest.
Oh, tornado. You're not going to come stepping over here on my mama's house. Get out of here.
I'm thinking like instead of the Ernest films, like Elvis saves Christmas. Elvis scared stupid.
Well, I mean, he did a bunch. King Creole is actually pretty good. That was
Elvis
good...
defeats the drug culture with Richard Nixon.
So we got G.I. Blues.
Oh, come on, you know that he got a badge, right?
What?
From Richard Nixon? Elvis.
Oh,
federal marshal.
For his service?
Well, he walked up to the White House and said, hey, you can, you know, use me as like a press release if you just give me a badge. So they did.
So here's kind of the funny thing, and I may actually get the name of the movie wrong, but I don't think I will. I'm pretty sure it's Follow That Dream. Mm. So the movie Follow That Dream, I believe it starts out with Elvis's car going down the road, and they're going like the other direction, like, you know, other cars are going the other direction. But here's the funniest thing. My mother-in-law actually claims that... one of the cars that passes Elvis's car was her family car that they were going, like, they knew that Elvis was filming in like the area. And so they said they saw this car just coming along, like, and there was a camera and stuff. And then all of a sudden their car passed. And so now it's like turned into this funny little thing of like my mother-in-law was in a movie with Elvis, even though she was a tiny little toddler at the time.
That's still pretty cool.
Or at least her car was in there, the family car. So there you go. I think it was Follow That Dream, but I could be mistaken. My dad would absolutely know. So, Dad, if you're listening to this, remind me which one it is.
Are you guys ready for a little bit of irony?
Ooh, what you got?
1966, Gene Clark of the Byrds announced he was leaving the band due to his fear of flying.
Mm. Wow.
Da-dunch.
Ebony. And irony,
I'm a bird, but I won't fly to your show.
I always thought the Byrds were kind of a funny group. Like, you know, they had some good songs, but it was just, it was sort of a funny little thing because, you know, they were an American rock band, obviously, right? And the Beatles had come out, huge, huge deal. And then, like, the Byrds went on a UK tour. And for some reason... like, the promotions people decided to announce them as America's response to the Beatles. And David Crosby, of course, who was in the band, said, like, you know, like, we weren't the response to anything. Like, we were just a band trying to play. It's like, what everybody tried to make it out is like, oh, it's the Byrds versus the Beatles in a, you know, across the Atlantic match. But it was nothing of the sort. Like, and actually, David Crosby really, really loved the Beatles. And, you know, honestly, he was like, you know, we couldn't hold a torch to the Beatles. They were just like, they were up here and we were down here.
I would almost feel like I would be like, I was getting set up to fail in that instance.
Oh, absolutely. Like, they thought, you know, hey, if we promote it this way, then we're going to get more people listening. I said, all they did was just piss people off.
Like, as a drummer, it's like, Greg Harvey is the next Neil Peart. And then when people see me play and they're like,
you don't
awful.
Sound anything like him.
Yeah. It's like, well, thanks for setting the bar so high. Jeez.
I'd like to point out to you, this is a complete, total side path here. So over the weekend, my wife and I are driving, and she's got like her radio stations because she's got Sirius XM radio, bouncing around from stuff to stuff, and twice she lands on a Rush song, and I start singing along to it, and she's like looks at me because of course I'm doing air drums to Neil's playing, and I do like one of the off hits that he does, and she's like, you're such a nerd. And I was like, so? It's Rush. Leave me alone.
That's awesome.
And I was like, Neil Peart retired. Like, and she's like, that's fine. Just wait till he unretires again. It's like, okay,
just
fine.
Wait till he's reborn.
I'm pretty sure there's a ton of drummers out there, though, who are as good as him. It's just that, you know, he became famous for all of that. And then, like, writing all the songs.
He's
and, like,
cool.
Yeah, I mean, Neil was just awesome.
The professor on the drum kit.
Yes, 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 yes. All right, in 1967, for March 1st, working at Abbey Road Studios, London, the Beatles started recording a new John Lennon song, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. The song was inspired by a drawing his three-year-old son Julian had returned home with from school that day, because there was a girl named Lucy O'Donnell, and so he drew a picture of her in the sky with diamonds. And then John converted that into a song, which then caused a big hullabaloo, because everybody was like, it stands for LSD. It's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. That's LSD.
Well, I mean,
they're doing drugs. They're bad.
I can see where you would make that assumption.
I'm sure John actually was like, oh, that's really cool. Lucy in the Sky. Oh, that's pretty funny. Good job, Julian. I like Julian's music, actually. He was a pretty cool dude.
Ooh, I see what our next one is.
What you got?
I think Jake's got this one.
Ooh, 1969.
Yep.
The release of the first synthesized album using exclusively the Moog synthesizer.
Moog?
By Wendy Carlos. It's called Switched on Bach.
The Moog.
This is not the one
the
I
Moog.
Thought. I didn't. Eh.
Moog. Moog.
Moog. Moog.
Moog?
The guy's name
Let's call
is,
the whole thing off.
The guy's name is Moog, but he doesn't care if you call his creation a Moog.
Moeg?
Just the way it is. M-O-O-G. Moog.
How do you pronounce it? Hit us up on Twitter.
Potato, potato.
So I was actually thinking of the other thing that happened the same day on 1969. This one, talking about Mr. L.A. himself, Jake. You know who I'm talking about?
This is so much more scandalous than mine.
No.
Jim Morrison.
Come on, Jim Morrison.
Was charged with lewd and, I can't even pronounce this word.
Lascivious.
Lascivious. Lascivious behavior.
Behavior.
After, Miami, Florida.
After showing his dong to the audience
allegedly.
During a show in Miami. Did you
allegedly.
Say allegedly?
Allegedly.
Well, the sentence here says that he did it. He was found guilty and sentenced to 8 months of hard labor.
Yeah, that's what I thought was funny when I read that. Hard labor. It's after like, he whipped his dick out on stage. What should we punish him with?
Snooze, snooze.
Hard labor.
Death by snooze, snooze.
Let's make him break rocks with a hammer. Like, yeah, that sounds about right. That's an appropriate response for whipping your dick out.
Although here, there is a catch to this, too. Morrison actually died while the sentence was on appeal.
Yep.
So he went out on a high note?
A kind Morrison of. Note.
A very Morrison note. Note.
He's
yeah.
up there on stage, and he's just like, excuse me while I whip this out.
Which took forever because he was wearing leather pants.
Yeah, that would have taken a good long while. Unless there was like just straight baby powder.
One more time around, guys. Give me another hook.
It's like just straight baby powder down there, and he finally gets it out, and it's just like a magic show.
So you're telling me he was wearing pants too tight, and he broke on through to the other side?
Oh. Oh,
people
man.
Are strange.
All right, I got one, though. Jumping up a couple of decades.
Let's do it.
Let's... Well, not a couple of decades, just a few years, really. Let's see. In 1975, Jake the Eagles
his favorite
went to
band.
Number one on the U.S. singles chart
your
with
favorite,
Best of My Love.
It's your favorite band, Jake. Yeah.
Jake is dying right now because...
Elizabeth, I'm coming
it's
to
your
meet
favorite
you.
He can't,
band. This is the big one.
Can't stand the Eagles.
He can't stand to be without the Eagles. No, I can't. I'm sorry. Like, once I get past... seven guitar parts written at one time, I kind of just quit caring.
No.
And steel
no.
drums.
Like, let's put a glockenspiel up there already.
Oh, okay.
How many instruments can we fit in a studio? And have one person try and attempt to play them all.
I got another U.S. number one here in 1986. Mr. Mister started a two-week run at number one on the U.S. singles chart with Kyrie, the group's second U.S. number one.
Wow.
I was like that.
They had two hits.
That was a great song. Kyrie eleison down the road that I must travel. You know what Kyrie eleison means? I had to sing it. I had to sing a song of that in choir because it's actually a liturgy used a lot in masses involving Latin or Greek.
Leison?
Kyrie eleison.
Eleison.
Yes. I never had any idea what the actual lyrics were until this moment.
Lord have mercy.
Lord of mercy.
Lord have mercy.
Hmm.
Not like Uncle Jesse from the Full House, but just like, Lord have mercy upon me. So when he says, Kyrie eleison down the road that I must travel, he's saying, Lord have mercy upon me as I travel.
I like that. Maybe I like the song more now.
It does have a deeper meaning. It is wrapped in this very pop rock-esque song. Tons of synthesizers. But if you actually go back and listen to the song, the dude's voice is incredible. And it has modulation in it. They go up a key, like, in the song. And it's like, wow, I didn't think that dude could actually hit that note. So, I mean, it's an impressive song, and it's got a lot of really great layered harmonies and stuff in there, too. You don't hear that a lot with modern pop music. But I see, Jake, I think you got something else, don't you?
Yes, we do.
What you
just
got?
Just to wrap this all up.
Well, I mean, I still got one more for this day. But
okay,
still.
Well, then to just push this along. March 1st, 1991, the Oliver Stone biopic The Doors, starring Val Kilmer, premieres at Grauman's Chinese Theater.
So a few years back, Jim Morrison whips his dick out and then dies a bit later.
Well, next thing you know, they got a movie.
Decade later, there's a movie starring Val Kilmer.
Starring Jim.
Didn't he do his own vocals for that, too? Val Kilmer?
Yeah, he
like
did.
He recorded all the vocals for that. That's what I always thought was impressive. And the same thing with the Buddy Holly story with what's his name?
Good old what's his name?
Oh, man. He's crazy now. He's like an actor.
Gary Busey.
Yeah. So I always thought that one was kind of crazy.
Yeah, I love hearing him talk about that because he's like, I talked to a friend, a buddy, and he said, you took a little part of him and put it in your soul. That's how you sang them songs.
Wow, that is so good, Jake.
Thank you.
Wow.
Just wait till we get
that's
to my Jesse
like
Ventura.
You were planning like that
legitimately
one.
Creeped me out.
Well, I practiced that at home, you know.
All right. So the final one that I got for March 1st is... 1994, Nirvana played their final concert when they appeared at the Terminal 1 in Munich, Germany. The 3,000 capacity venue was a small airport hangar.
That means Terminal 1.
The power actually went off during the concert, and so they did an impromptu acoustic set. Boom. Yes.
They played The Cars, My Best Friend's Girl.
Surprisingly, also in, I believe, a different day, but on this same week, Nirvana actually won a Grammy Award for the Unplugged album on MTV's Unplugged that they did, which is honestly one of the best things that I think that they ever did.
You them when they play the Meat Puppets better than when the Meat Puppets play the Meat Puppets?
Dude! Lake of Fire? Oh, so good.
So good.
So good.
All right, so let's move on to March 2nd. We still got, you know, March 2nd and March 3rd to do, and we got a lot of stuff to get through. All right, so Jake, I know we were talking about this beforehand, but this one I love, right? Because this dude has a special place in my heart. In 1955, Bo Diddley had his first recording session at Universal Recording Studio in Chicago. The Beatles actually recorded there too a couple of different times, I believe. And so he laid down the track, Bo Diddley. Did his first song. He actually is credited as having that chunk style playing. And he actually tried to kind of copyright that rhythm. And then, like, if anybody ever tried to use it, he was like going to try and sue them. But at the same time, it's Bo Diddley. So, I mean, you just let Bo Diddley do.
I saw Bo Diddley do. I like that. I love seeing a concert. Probably a decade ago, Bo Diddley, Eric Clapton.
Yep.
That kid, was it Derek Trucks? The kid who's a great guitarist for Eric Clapton's band, but he's young. Isn't that his name? Like Derek Trucks? I'm thinking of somebody else.
You're going over my head. I don't know that one.
Well, he's not widely known, but he's a fantastic guitar player. Anyways, there was like a star-studded concert, and Bo came out, and he did I Want Diddley, it was awesome, star-studded event, one of my favorite moments, and that was recent, too. I mean, Bo Diddley's been around for a long time.
We talked about Elvis before, right? And this one blew my mind. In 1960, after completing his national service and flying back to America, Elvis Presley stepped on British soil for the first and only time in his life. when the plane carrying him stopped for refueling in Scotland. The dude was a megastar. One of the biggest icons in music history. Never went back to the UK.
And the only reason he was there was because he had to.
Because of stopover.
He had to get stop and get gas.
But he was coming back from military service, and so it's like they just had to stop there because there was, you know, the base and everything before flying back to the U.S. Just mind-boggling for me because I had no idea. It's like I thought for sure that Elvis at some point had gone to, you know, the U.K. to play or something.
Well,
nope.
Yeah.
Never.
Well, and that's what you're saying, is that even the one time he was there, it had nothing to do with music.
Nothing.
Nothing. It's like, that's silly. He was probably, come on, that dude loved Las Vegas. He was probably why don't you just come on down and see
me? Yeah, but that just, it blew my mind that could happen in this day and age. Man, that is just funny.
He's like, it's a little chilly here. I'm never coming back.
It's like, Scotland sucks.
Well, that also goes to show you how much money he was making for the studio that they never thought, hey, we got to send this guy overseas.
Yeah, that's true. Show. That's true.
We'll just keep raking in the cash right here.
Yeah, exactly. In 1963, the Four Seasons became the first group to have three consecutive number ones in the U.S. when Walk Like a Man started a three-week run at the top of the charts.
The question
walk
still to this
like
day,
a man.
How do you walk like a man?
You just do.
You just do.
No woman's worth.
Don't worry.
On the earth.
Well, if you watch the Patterson-Gimlin like footage, you can clearly see that it's not walking like a man. The way the hips sway with the arm moving, those feet are landing flat. There's no heel toe going on there.
This is Bigfoot, right?
Right, yeah.
So here's the thing. I'm going to tell you this. This is my own personal history right here. Back to back here, I got Elvis Presley and the Four Seasons, right? First two records I ever bought. Greatest Hits of Elvis. Greatest Hits of the Four Seasons. A neighbor was having a yard sale, and she sold a bunch of her vinyl records. First two vinyl records I ever bought were those two. And because of that, I learned a bunch of Elvis songs, and I learned a bunch of Four Seasons songs. And I learned, like, it was the first time that I ever realized that, like, I truly wanted to be a musician. Because I was listening to the Four Seasons and breaking down all of their harmony parts. And so I was singing bass lines. I was singing the, you know, like high tenor. I was singing like all of this stuff, just trying to figure out who was singing what and who was doing what, and then actually repeating that process. I mean, mind you, I was like 9 at this time, and I was still just trying to figure this stuff out. So for my own personal history, Elvis and the Four Seasons will always be like the thing that really kicked off my my journey as a musician. Especially as like a singer. Now, of course, I can't also say that it was just that because my dad was like one of the biggest influences on my life. And my dad is one of the best singers that I've ever seen. Ever. So Jake is shaking his head because he knows.
Yeah. Random people ask him to sing the national anthem.
Yeah.
Just on the street because, well, they're crazy. And
I just.
My dad will sing anywhere. My dad will honestly sing.
I don't know why.
Anywhere.
For some reason, the first thing I thought, though, was that you would have some viral video where, like, you're walking down the street, and then you just stop, and you, like, ask everyone around you, like, please rise and remove your hats now for the national
for the
anthem.
National anthem.
And you just start singing it, like, in a public space, and see people, like, awkwardly, like, I don't know, should I stand up? This guy just walked up to me and started singing.
Well, no, the story, actually, it's an amazing story. I'm just going to tell it.
Go ahead.
I'm going to tell it.
Good.
So
You have as many stories about my dad as I do.
True.
So
he was waiting in line for tickets for, I believe, the 82 World Series.
It could have been. I think
it was the 82 World Series.
I wasn't born yet.
He should have been at home with his pregnant wife.
And sitting on a step outside of the Old Bush Stadium, and he fell asleep, and he gets woken up by somebody shaking his shoulder, and he says, hey, sing the national anthem. So, of course, Adam, being Adam, stands up and just belts it out. Thunder throat crowd going crazy, and the guy stands slack-jawed in amazement and says, thank you, and runs down the sidewalk pumping his fist. He's just pumped. He can't believe he just got this personal concert from him. And Adam turns around to the guy standing in line behind him and goes, man, I don't know how that guy knew I was a singer. It must have been like, must have been God told him or something. And the dude says, man, when you were asleep, he walked up and down this line and asked everyone behind you to sing. And you were the only one that did it.
Oh, man. But seriously, like, I don't know how, I mean, we got onto this weird side tangent about my dad, but my dad will sing like at the drop of a hat. It doesn't matter. But the thing that I love the most, it's like, and to this day, he will still do this. If he's ever in a place where there's an echo of some kind, he will sing at the top of his lung, "Eli's Coming," the great Three Dog Night like intro song or intro to the song, "Eli's Coming." He's like, just "Eli's Coming." It's like, it's just as loud as he can just to see the echo. And it's like, oh my, yes. I've seen so many people just stare at my father slack jawed, you know, because he sang that. And everybody's like, holy cow.
Wow.
Like, that dude's voice is just so loud. It's so great because, like, I mean, you see me. I mean, most of the people who obviously are listening to this can't see me, but I'm a big dude. I'm 6'6". I'm just a giant of a man. And my father is not. My father is 5'5". And so he's like this shorter dude and, you know, kind of unassuming, like you know, but he, whenever he starts to sing, it is just the most powerful thing you will hear.
Wow.
Big voices come in small packages all the time.
Yep. Mm. Ronnie James Dio.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see. We left off on the Four Seasons. Let's go to 1964. The Beatles began filming their first feature film, A Hard Day's Night, one of my all-time favorite musicals.
Yeah.
I think that's all that needs to be said about that.
Yeah. It's number two on my list of like favorite musicals, number one being Blues Brothers.
I was just going to say.
Yeah.
We talked about that a few weeks ago, actually.
We did. I don't even think we need to talk about it. Just watch the film. Hard Day's Night.
If you haven't, it's brilliant. The soundtrack is amazing. And the comedy is, it stands the test of time. It's just funny stuff.
I don't really want to talk about them. But
let's go.
1967, I just wanted to mention that Engelbert Humperdinck was number one.
I can't believe that Engelbert Humperdinck is his stage name. Just saying.
So, I know you had some controversies and stuff before, especially we've had some Jim Morrison ones, but here's the one that I liked, right? 1975, policemen stopped a Lincoln Continental for running a red light in Los Angeles. They were surprised to find Sir Paul McCartney and his wife Linda. And the cop was like, "Hey, you're Paul McCartney and Linda McCartney. Hey, is that weed? All right, I got to search the car." Searches the car, finds a few ounces of weed in the car, and arrests Linda. She's like, that's mine. That's not Paul's at all. It's like, and the guy's like flashing back to that one interview that Paul did where they were just like, "Do you smoke marijuana?" And he's just like, "Yeah. Yes, I smoke it. Like, all the time."
When you're married to a Beetle, it's always that
Linda.
Time to fall on the sword.
Linda.
Linda.
Linda. Just take the fall, Linda.
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 Hold this for me.
Hold this for me, Linda.
All right. And then the final one that I got for... Oh, no. It's not the final one for March 2nd. I'm skipping past stuff. But 1983, a new digital audio system, a 5-inch compact disc containing up to 1 hour of music, was launched by Sony, Philips, and PolyGram.
Up to 1 whole hour?
Wow.
60 minutes of nonstop rock?
And CD players only cost a cheap $2,500.
Wait. 60 minutes of nonstop rock on 44.3? The W.
That's good stuff. But we just did Hard Day's Night filming. Jake, I know you got another one that's grand. Go for it.
Oh, this could take an entire episode. It's in and
of itself. Probably will.
1984, a little film you might have heard of that changed the world premiered. Live straight from hell, this is Spinal Tap.
Oh, this is Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
What was that? Wait. Fluffner? What was the dude's name?
Oh man, I don't remember that one.
Fluffkins, right?
Fluffkins, yes.
Wasn't it Arnie Fluffkins? Wasn't that?
I keep trying to remember the intro that they did when they played their first US show. And he's like, you know, he's like, "We're Spinal Tap from the UK. You must be the USA."
Oh yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, Boston canceled. Don't worry, it's not a big college town.
Which, you know what I love to, and I mean, we're totally going to have to, we absolutely have to do an entire episode on Spinal Tap, and I'd love to then also segue that into A Mighty Wind, which like featured basically all the same players, just in a completely different iteration, but
somehow dumber.
Somehow dumber, but still, like, the music was just fantastic.
Man.
But Spinal Tap, you know, like, if you actually watch the movie, though, and you listen to the commentary, the commentary is them as themselves, as the people
characters
in the band.
Oh, my gosh.
And so...
I gotta watch the commentary now.
The commentary is just hilarious.
Them commenting on their
fake documentary, like, is just...
I could hear like
brilliant,
like Nigel, you know, being like when he's like, but this one goes to 11. And then like him on the commentary being like, but that amp really did go to 11. And it was
so
special.
So when they said, you know, it's not a big college town. They're like, he lied. He lied right there. It's like we found out later on that it was a huge college town.
It was a huge college town.
There's like loads of colleges. It's like, but he lied to us. Like, it's just, it was so funny just listening to them go back and forth
on it. The humor of that movie was just on a different level because it was so smart and stupid at the same time. Because you have to be brilliant to come up with some of the stupid stuff that happened. One of my favorites was when they come out of the pods and Derek Smalls can't get out of his pod. And then he finally gets out of the end of the song and he like... gets all excited, and then they're already back in the pod, so he gets back in, and then it closes shut on him, and his arm is stuck out of it. Oh, my gosh. What a all movie. Right. Or the 2-meter-tall Stonehenge. Stonehenge was seriously in danger of being crushed by, like, a dog.
Nigel knows the difference between inches and feet is not my problem. My problem is getting this band to the next show. But you're not as confused as Nigel, are you?
All right, the next two I got are kind of sad, though, since we have that grand one of Spinal Tap.
Everybody, stop smiling.
But 1999, Dusty Springfield died after a long battle with cancer, age 59. Mm. The British singer had her first UK single in 1963 with I Only Want to Be With You, which reached number 4. And in 66 in the UK, number 1 in the UK, number 4 in the US, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. You don't have to say you love me, just be close at hand.
Dusty Springfield.
Oh, man. She was grand. She was a great, great lady. And then, of course, in 2008, Canadian guitarist and singer Jeff Healy died of cancer. Healy had lost his sight in a rare cancer of the eyes and had them surgically removed, and therefore he was blind from that moment on, but he became an incredible guitar player and did a bunch of the music in the soundtrack to one of the greatest manly macho films of all time, Roadhouse.
Roadhouse.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a punchline, but that's actually better than
that. That is better than come up with. So Jeff Healy is actually like in the movie and everything, and it cracks me up because he's like there and like he find him and he's behind chicken wire and stuff. It's like, yep, because you definitely need to protect the blind guy from having stuff thrown at him.
Well, I mean, he can't see it coming.
Exactly. Just like, you know, Mike Cable to good old Ray Charles.
That was sick.
All right, so let's move on to March 3rd. I don't have a whole ton for March 3rd, but I can do this. So, 1966, Neil Young, Stephen Stills, and Richie Furay formed Buffalo Springfield in Los Angeles.
With something happening here.
There you go.
That is ain't exactly clear.
The appearance of them on The Muppets was... something else.
I just watched the Trailer Park Boys, the one where they go to Europe, and while they're in Amsterdam, they get to go to a Stills and Nash concert, I think. And
Crosby was unavailable.
It was something like that. they get to go to the concert. Oh my gosh, it's ridiculous. It's really not something you can almost talk about, but long story short is that they get to meet the guys and they're learning to sing a song, and meanwhile, Ricky sneaks off and pees in their dressing rooms and it causes them to get kicked out. But like, it's the actual guys on the show. And they're like, wait, what? Like, you peed in our... 'Cause it was very realistic.
In 1973, Slade's Come On, Feel the Noise entered the UK at number one, making Slade the first act to achieve it since The Beatles.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Come On, Feel the Noise by Slade.
What year was this?
1973.
Wow. So that much time passed.
Oh, yeah. And the song would become a much bigger hit much later on in the 80s.
Wow.
By a different band who re-recorded it.
Yeah.
Quiet Riot.
I like those guys.
And that would be like their only major hit.
It's like yelling but whispering.
Yep. Here we go. In 1995, the Foo Fighters made their live debut at a benefit show in Portland, Oregon.
That's awesome. Foo Fighters rock.
Yep. I will still always, for the rest of my life, be saddened by the fact that I was unable to see the Foo Fighters at Wembley Stadium in the UK.
Wembley? How did you? I would have broken every law possible.
No, they. This is funny you say broken.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what happened to Dave Grohl's leg the week before when he fell off of the stage and broke his leg and was unable to play at the concert at Wembley Stadium. So there we were in London, right next to Wembley Stadium, and nothing. It's like, because the show was both nights were canceled.
Man.
And so then we're like, well, what else are we going to do in London? So we just ended up meandering around. The best part, though, we ended up actually seeing a concert that week, because that same week at the O2 Stadium, Fleetwood Mac was playing, and we totally went and saw
them.
That
is sweet.
It was fantastic.
Hey, music trivia question for you guys.
Go.
Do you know what a Foo Fighter is? Do you know what fighting foos is all about?
It was shorthand for UFO, right?
I was going to say.
That is correct.
Aliens.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Foo Fighters. Mm-hmm. The foos are the little white balls of light that they chased around. They didn't know what it was, so it was a UFO.
Are those grays or are those reptoid aliens?
I think they're grays.
Mm, okay, then.
All right, so in 1999, Oasis agreed to pay their former drummer, Tony McCarroll, a one-off sum of £550,000 or $935,000 American dollars
to make him go away.
After he sued the Manchester band for millions in unpaid royalties, McCarroll was sacked from the band in 95, so it took him 4 years to get almost $1 million from them.
Hmm.
It's crazy.
There's a music biz for you.
They probably spent it all on
They fired booze. Him because they felt that he wasn't good enough to do like the next album.
That's rough.
I think that's what it was. So, they ended up hiring somebody else.
That's the hardest part of being a drummer. It's being self-conscious and being like, they're going to get a new drummer.
That's all I got for the actual stuff this week in music history. I thought that was a great listing.
Yes.
When I was going through it originally, I was like, man, this is some good stuff. I'm quite happy with that. But before we move on to the next bit, our show is obviously sponsored by Lineup. Not sponsored by, brought to you by LineupMedia.fm. LineupMedia.fm has tons of programming for your enjoyment. I would definitely suggest, if you like our music history show and you just love history in general, you've got to listen to This Day in History. It is a daily made show, new show every single day, done by Tony Hubert and Armand Kachigian. Armand Kachigian is one of these dudes who's like really, really smart, but he's also a little crass too. So he's just he's a goofy, goofy dude. But he was on a bunch of different game shows back in like the 90s, like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Win Ben Stein's Money and
Dating
Game as well, which was pretty funny. But he's just a really smart dude, and so he's got a lot of interaction. And Tony, in his own right, has a bunch of historical knowledge, and he and I go back and forth all the time because we work in the same office. And so check out This Day in History. You can find them at thisdayinhistory.com, I believe. You can find them on Facebook and Twitter and all that, because I'm sure they would enjoy a lovely conversation. Get on there and start arguing with Armand about some historical fact. Remember, he is a hardcore conservative and a Trump supporter, so get on there.
Yes, and thank you very much, Lineup Media. Without you, we'd have one less segment.
Exactly. So the show has actually gone on a lot longer than what we have normally done, so I've decided to just split it up to make it easier to download. And so this has been the end of part one, where we cover all of our normal stuff, the bulk of the show, but we're going to split the other part in there too and give you all of the number one hits of the past and all of the birthdays and that kind of stuff. So thank you for listening to Follow the Sound. I'm Brian Kroc. I had Greg Harvey and Jacob Crum with me, and enjoy part two when you click to it.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.